This is the Medicast, January 1st, 2007. Happy New Year.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast episode 47. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I want to thank all of you for checking out this podcast. Well, it's 2007. It's a brand new year for all of us to make our New Year's resolutions. And I want all of you to join me in making a New Year's resolution to make ourselves the best medical providers in the field that we can, to work hard on studying, paying attention to our continuing education, and looking for more opportunities for continuing education. And I hope that that includes staying here listening to the Medicast. If you're a brand new listener to the show, I want to welcome you. Check out a couple of the episodes in the archives. You can check out the website at www.medicast.com and click on the link to the left there for podcast under categories, and that'll give you links to all the show notes and all the episodes in the back episodes category there. And check out and stick around for the next few episodes as well and get a sense of what the Medicast is all about. And of course, for all of you longtime listeners, I want to thank you for your contributions, your questions, your comments, and encouragement for me to continue doing this show. I'm looking forward to the new year. I've got a lot of exciting things lined up. If you want to check out what they are, check back at the beginning of last week's episode, and I cover a little bit of that on the Christmas Day episode, on the December 25th episode. As I said, I've gotten quite a bit of encouragement and email from listeners in the past week, and I want to thank you for all of your comments. Here's a few of the comments I got. Listener Wesley is an EMTB from Texas, and he was checking out on how to get earlier shows from the iTunes Music Store because it only goes back to episode 12, and he wanted to get some more information on drugs and things. Wesley, you can check out the website. You'll see a list of links there in the left-hand side, and you can check out how to look at the list of drugs of the week and tips and tricks of the week that I've covered, and you can also check the podcast category, and that goes all the way back to episode 1. The iTunes link only goes back to episode 12 because I had to change the way that the RSS feed was covered for technical reasons, and you can hear all about that if you check back around episode, say, I don't know, probably episode 18, 19, and 20, somewhere in there around mid-July is when I switched over. But thank you very much for your encouragement, and I will be doing some more information upcoming on the National Registry tests, both the practical and taking the written test or the computer test, as the case may be. I got another email from listener Michael, who is also out of Texas. He's an EMTI, and he was encouraging me to get started on getting some of the premium services I discussed last week up on the site. And Michael, I will get on that, but I want to make sure that it doesn't take away from the weekly show I do here on the Medicast. I will not be taking away from this free podcast to work on premium services. I want to make sure that you guys are still getting all the bang for your buck that you've gotten to date. He also had a question about some legislation he'd heard about through the grapevine regarding requiring ambulance services to have a certain minimum amount of coverage in their area. And I hadn't heard anything about it, Michael. I don't think it's going to be a federal initiative. You may have heard about something in the Texas legislature. Every state in this country, as well as every country around the world, has varying differences in the way they handle EMS. And I know that just from Maryland to Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Virginia, we have widely different ways we handle EMS in this area. And there's just different ways the state handles oversight over EMS services and what services can possess ALS capabilities and which ones can't, what services must be provided and what services are not to be provided by public service ambulance companies. And my best question to you would be to maybe check in with your legislature and your local representative and find out what they know about. Maybe they can do some research for you and get some more information. And any other listeners down there in Texas, and I know there's quite a few of you, if you've heard of anything that can help Michael out, shoot me an email and I can either forward it on to him or I'll cover it here on the show. But I want to thank you very much, Michael, for your comments, and keep the comments coming and continue asking questions. I'll try to find the answers for you. Lastly, I got a great email from Singapore from a gentleman by the name of Azar, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. But he's a registered nurse and an Army medic with a level 2 paramedic background, and he's just checking in and likes the show and is going to be linking back to my site. And I appreciate that, Azar. I'll put a link on the site here in the next few days that'll link back to your blog over at Blogspot. He has got quite a bit of some good information on his site as well. And so I'll link to that in an upcoming post on my site. So just to let you know. And everybody else, keep the comments coming, questions coming. And if you have something you'd like to talk about, if you have a class that you like to teach or a program that you're very interested in and would like to talk about, give me a shout here at the MedicCast podcast. You can reach me here by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also check out the website at www.medicast.com. And you can leave comments at the bottom of every post. There is a way to leave comments on each individual posting. And so if you have something you want to discuss, a program you're working on, maybe you're doing something with safety in the schools and really educating kids out there about how to be safe in their communities, something like that, or you're reaching out to the elderly population for education on their health issues, let me know. I'd really be interested in hearing about it. I think we all benefit by sharing some of these things, and maybe we can get some initiatives spread around more than just your individual local area, and that would be a good thing. So make sure you check back here and contact me about any of that. Moving right into the news for this week, I found an interesting story out of Evansville, Indiana, and it had to do with a November 6th, 2005 tornado that hit that area and hit a mobile home park there. And it talks to, this is actually a TV news story, and there's actually video accompanying it on the website, and there's a link to all this in the show notes. But they talked to an EMT about his impressions on the scene when he first got to this mobile home park and started responding to help people. And, you know, I talk all the time here on the MedicCast about being prepared, reviewing your protocols regularly, reviewing your triage skills, practicing mass casualty incidents in your communities with neighboring companies and with local resources. Last week, I talked with Rick Rosati about National Incident Management System training and, you know, all the things that you can get out of that and how it's not just for chief officers. It's really for everybody to get a handle on. And so this is something that's near and dear to my heart and I think should be important to all of us in EMS. This story is about Ryan Winters, who was in the thick of this rescue effort for about an hour before anyone else made it to help him back him up. And so picture this, you're an EMT firefighter, you're alone, you have just what you carry with you in your regular kit, you know, whatever you've got in your pockets, whatever you've got, maybe you've got some BLS supplies in the back of your vehicle. So what do you do when you hit a situation where you roll up onto the scene of devastation where there's literally nothing left? I mean, he describes this place as it was flattened. All he had was a flashlight, and he walked around in the dark. There wasn't a home in sight, just rubble everywhere. He heard people screaming, but he couldn't see anyone because everyone was asleep and was literally buried in the rubble of their mobile homes in this community. People were coming up to him bleeding. They were carrying people, and they just wanted help. They kept saying, where's the help? Are you here to help? So he talks about what he did that night, and I think it's a lesson for all of us on being prepared. He talks about just working one by one. He just started at one end and just started working his way through. He found people trapped under the frames of their trailer, the steel I-beams, and unable to free them. So he was calling for help on his radio, and there was nobody out there. He eventually got a hold of his deputy chief, and the deputy chief said, well, I've sent you people, but it was still a half an hour, and he hadn't gotten any word and hadn't seen anybody yet. But, you know, these other responders were running into the same problem. On the way to helping him, they were coming upon other people that had issues, and they had to deal with things as they got to them one by one as well. So what did he do? Well, he got volunteers from the area that were walking around that had already freed themselves to help him out. He organized himself as the incident commander. I mean, he was it, right? So he had to organize his resources. He talked about using available pieces of lumber and doors to act as stretchers, organize litter bearers, organize people to break into cars so they could turn on the headlights so that they had more light on the scenes, and all these things that he had to do to organize a rescue effort where an entire mobile home park was destroyed by a tornado. And, you know, this is a lesson for all of us, and I want to applaud him. Ryan, you did a fantastic job. This isn't really new news, but it's from a year ago. But I think this story has something to teach all of us, whether you're a firefighter primarily or whether you're in the EMS community. We all need to be prepared. You don't know when you're going to be called in the middle of the night to wake up and you're going to be alone for a significant period of time as the sole trained first responder in a community. And that's scary, but it could happen. And we need to be prepared for that. Well, there's more motor vehicle accidents involving ambulances in the news. This week in Alaska, near Anchorage, they actually had two ambulances involved in motor vehicle accidents in 2 days. And you'll see a link to this in the show notes as well. But apparently, in the first accident, three medics involved in the accident were injured when a pickup truck struck their ambulance during a patient transport. And on the second incident, they were actually transporting a patient from an MVA when they were struck by another crash, another car, and had their own accident. Now, nobody was seriously injured in the second accident, but this is just, again, I just bring these things up as they come to mind because I think we really, really need to just be extra careful. We are not immune to being stuck in the same kinds of situations we end up rescuing other people from. And we need to be aware just because we're in a big vehicle with flashing lights that anybody is likely or even paying attention to us. So check out the link to this in the show notes. I talk about these kind of things all the time, and I think it's important for us to keep the safety of our vehicles and our crews in the forefront of our minds when we're traveling. Last week, I talked about 911 call takers and specifically the 911 call service in Wicomico County here in Maryland and how they were really underpaid and having trouble keeping their services staffed with trained personnel. Well, I found another article today about a 911 call taker in Montgomery County, Maryland, who was receiving a thank you from people that he helped over the phone when their baby was born suddenly in their home and they were unable to resuscitate the child. This is one of those situations, you know, we don't get thank yous that often, but we probably get them a whole lot more often than dispatchers get thank yous for taking calls on the phone in stressful situations and remaining calm. I don't know if any of you have had any parents that have required tech support on their computers like my dad does quite frequently, but it's very frustrating staying calm and giving instructions for anything over the phone. And I'm just talking about computer support. I can't imagine the type of calmness it takes to be calm over the telephone when people are freaking out and trying to get them to listen to you and pay attention to your voice. So I think dispatchers are a special breed. This is a story about a dispatcher by the name of Richard Brown in Montgomery County, Maryland. And the parents were pregnant with their fifth child, and she started to give birth, and they called 911 to get help, and before they knew it, the baby was born but was not breathing. And Richard was able to get them calmed down and talk them through the process of resuscitating their child, and was successful. And this just goes to show that we got to remember we're part of a team out there. So when you get an opportunity to, whether you're talking on the radio or calling in the dispatch, make sure that you thank your dispatchers for backing you up, for being available at the other end of that radio when you need to call for help, when you need to call for assistance, or you just want to hear a friendly voice. And I think that's important for all of us to stay connected with each other. So kudos to Richard Brown, a dispatcher in Montgomery County, Maryland, for his calmness and his professional work ethic and attitude. So you're all eating your fruits and vegetables, right? Well, up till now, it's been difficult to pinpoint exactly what it is about eating fruits and vegetables that makes them so heart healthy, specifically to reduce hypertension in a person who uses a diet that is rich in vegetables and fruits. Well, guess what, folks? It shouldn't be any surprise to us. It's actually related to something we use, whether we're BLS or ALS providers, all the time, and that's nitroglycerin. Now, not specifically the nitroglycerin that we use, but nitrates. And vegetables that are rich in nitrates are nature's way of keeping the blood pressure in our bodies under control. Vegetables like spinach and lettuce, as well as other green leafy vegetables, are probably very rich in nitrates and therefore helpful in keeping blood pressure reduced and under control by causing mild vasodilation. So the next time you're thinking about getting something to eat for lunch and you're on the run, instead of going through that fast food drive-through, stop off at the supermarket when they're open during the day and grab yourself a salad at the salad bar. It's not that expensive. You can pile on everything you want, and you can make sure you get yourself the green leafy vegetables, spinach, and lettuce, and other things of that nature, and help yourself out. And pass the word along to your patients, your family members, and your friends as well. We need to encourage people to be as healthy as possible. Remember, prevention is part of our job as well, and not just preventing motor vehicle accidents, not just preventing children being injured in falls and riding their bikes and skateboarding, but also preventing other major health problems. The prevention efforts you make today will save you from running those extra calls 10 years down the road. And again, as I say this often, free you up for the true emergencies, because we can help people be healthier and take the strain off of us and off of our local hospitals and ERs. Finally, an update on new technology that we might see in the future on our ambulances. Those of you that have listened to the show for some time are familiar with me adding these little tidbits into the show. And I think it's important for us to understand what's out there and what we can look forward to. There are interesting technologies that will present us with the ability to perform blood tests in the back of our units to help us diagnose things like myocardial infarction and track other kinds of markers for stroke and other illnesses. Well, there's an article in the news today that says that we'll actually be able to use the same similar chip technology to find out what kind of sepsis or if patients are actually having a septic episode. This kind of nanotechnology is coming to the forefront as they create tiny pumps based on a molecular level technology. And what happens is you'd have a handheld device, maybe the size of a portable pulse oximeter. It would have a slot in the end, just like something you would use with a AccuCheck or blood stick, and you would use a sampling device, get a blood sample, and you'd insert it into this machine, and it would take the blood sample and pump it through a series of filters at the molecular level that would be set up to recognize certain things. Things like cardiac enzymes, things like enzymes released by the brain when there's strokes of different types. We might be able to diagnose hemorrhagic strokes versus thrombolytic strokes. We might be able to identify all kinds of things. And so it would also be able to detect the presence of toxins or bacteria that cause sepsis in patients. And this is something that's important to us. We see septic episodes sometimes in the field, and would be nice to know what they've got going on. Or is it an allergic response? Is it a septic response? What's going on? So this is just some interesting technology. There's a link to all these stories in the show notes. You can check those out for this episode at medicast.com. Well, it's time for this week's tip and trick of the week. And kind of picking off of last news story in the news earlier, I thought I'd jump in and talk a little bit about sepsis. This is something we don't encounter all that often, but it's a real life-threatening emergency, and it's something we need to be prepared for, both as ALS and BLS providers. Just a little note on tips and tricks here in the Medicast. I got an email from one of the listeners that wanted me to try to focus on some more BLS things. And I want to give you a little bit of my insight on BLS versus ALS. I was an EMTB. Became an IV tech, which is a EMTB add-on skill here in Maryland, and then moved on to paramedic. And I know a lot of EMTBs out there aspire to move on to paramedic someday, but some of you are not in that mode and are looking really strictly for BLS help. Well, I just want to encourage you to not put a block on yourself. Whether you decide to move on into higher education or not is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about making yourself the best provider you can be, whether you're at the BLS or the ALS level. And I think you need to focus on learning as much as you can, even about ALS skills. The better you are at assisting an ALS provider when they're in the unit with you, the better off the patient is all the way around. If you have an understanding of what that ALS provider is doing, if you have an inkling of what the next drug might be, then you're going to be better prepared to assist them in getting set up to administer that drug. You know, we're in a tightly confined space. We only have so many hands to push medications and handle IV lines and look at the heart monitor and other things we have. And the better we work with BLS providers in the back of our units, the better off the patient is. So I encourage you as BLS providers to listen to some of the ALS things I cover in this show, as well as the BLS things, and make yourself as broad an EMTB as you possibly can be. Who knows? Maybe you'll decide to move on to an ALS skill level, or maybe you won't, but you'll be a better provider for having the knowledge anyway. Moving right along into the sepsis portion of the show. Sepsis is a condition in which your body is fighting a severe infection. If you become septic or your patients become septic, they'll have a primarily low blood pressure reaction. So they're going to be in shock, and you're going to have to find out what this shock is from. This condition can develop either as a result of the body's defense system or as a result of a toxic substance like a bacteria, a virus, or a fungus. People who are particularly at risk for sepsis, people whose immune systems are compromised, like people who have AIDS or have another immune compromised illness like arthritis or lupus, people who have the immune systems that aren't completely developed, like the very, very young or the very, very old, may get sepsis and become infected severely if they're not treated rapidly. The number of people dying from sepsis has doubled in the past 20 years, but it's not because we aren't able to adequately care for sepsis. It's because the number of people who get sepsis has increased. And this is because we're better able to keep people alive past the point where they would have died 20 years ago. And so these people are having major medical complications, but are able to continue living and have a quality of life, but they are more susceptible to septic episodes. There's also related to the aging of the population, as well as somewhat an overuse of antibiotics to treat illnesses caused by viruses and not bacteria. So bacteria have become more resistant and are making the treatment of sepsis more difficult in some cases. And I covered this a few weeks ago when I talked about the MRSA, the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, as well as some other resistant organisms. So you can check back in the show notes for more on that. as well as I covered something on antibiotics back in episode 32. Many different microbes can cause sepsis, and although bacteria are primarily the most common cause, viruses and fungi can also cause septic episodes. The infections may start in the lungs, in the bladder or the kidneys, where there are urinary tract infections. They may also be caused in the skin through cellulitis or in the abdomen from such things as appendicitis, as well as other organs like meningitis. All of these infections can lead and spread throughout the body and become a total systemic septic episode. Infections also are more likely to develop following surgery. So these are all things you need to pay attention to. If the patient's had a recent cold or maybe had a recent bout with pneumonia or had an infection from a lesion in their skin and it was treated, perhaps it wasn't completely removed from the system and a resistant strain of bacteria was able to stay in the system and spread throughout the blood and eventually attack the whole body. What are you going to see when you have septic symptoms? Well, you'll often have a fever. You also maybe even have a low or normal body temperature, so that's not definitive. People may also experience chills, severe shaking, altered mental status. They may have a tachycardia and a tachypnea. They may also be confused or agitated, and they may have decreased urination because of fluid problems. Some people may also develop a rash on their skin. They may be a blotchy reddish discoloration, or it may be small dark red dots or petechiae throughout the body. And these are pretty easy to recognize if you know what you're looking for. The link in the show notes will lead you to a site that has some good pictures on page 9 of that site. So check that out and read that whole article. That's where I got a lot of this information. For septic treatment, it cannot be treated at home. Definitive care needs to happen at the hospital. Definitive care is going to include fluid volume increases, pressors like dopamine or Levofed, as well as hospitalization, most often in the ICU. So what are we going to do in the field? What are we going to do? Well, this is ALS or BLS, so everybody pay attention. First of all, you're going to put the patient on oxygen, probably a non-rebreather. You may want to consider if they're having a primary respiratory infection as the cause to use CPAP if you have it available, or be prepared to bag the patient if they crash suddenly on you. You may be wanting to start an IV if you're an ALS provider to start fluid volume replacement and try to get the pressure up. And if that doesn't work, be prepared to use dopamine. For you BLS providers out there, don't keep yourselves out of the window here. You can do things to increase blood pressure. First of all, lay the patient flat so that we get good blood flow to the brain and put them in Trendelenburg. You know, use that button on the bottom of your cots and lift up their legs. If you don't have that available for some reason, just prop their legs up on a piled up blankets and you'll get a temporary shift in fluid. This is only good for about 15 or 20 minutes, but it can get their blood pressure up long enough for you to get ALS response to your unit, or you can get the patient to the hospital. The prognosis for this is various and depends on your age. Overall, there's a 40% survival rate of severe sepsis, but that's deceptive. If you're a healthy person and otherwise have no other illness, the death rate is as low as 5% from sepsis. Where the high numbers come in involves the very elderly, the very young, and those that have immune compromise. And here the death rate may be as high as 80%. And it's important to understand that sepsis can set in very quickly. A patient can have fever and within just a few hours have a full-blown septic episode with their blood pressure crashing as their veins dilate as a result of the infection, trying to get rid of what's in their system. And so you have to get in there and give them fluids, use Trendelenburg, use positioning, use whatever it is you need to do to get that patient. And this is a true emergency. This is one of those situations where if you think sepsis is going on, you need to get them to the hospital. Just to use a family note and bring this home to you a little bit, my father had a septic episode as a result of a urinary tract infection. And I was at the hospital. He showed up incoherent, altered mental status. He's 80 years old, but pretty healthy otherwise. And when I got there, his pressure was hovering around 84 over 50. At one point, his pressure within the hour I was there dropped as low as 60 over 30. They gave him 3 liters of saline. That's right, 3,000 cc's of saline. It still didn't make a dent in his pressure while I was sitting there watching him hang bag after bag. They hung dopamine. It had very little effect. It only brought it up to about, you know, mid-70s systolic, and then it started to creep back down again. And eventually he was admitted to the ICU and was on Levofed for 2 days in the ICU until his blood pressure stabilized while they hung 3 different antibiotics around the clock to try to knock out what was in his system until they could identify it. So just as something that can happen and progress very quickly, in the course of an hour, I watched his blood pressure crash. And had he been home alone, he probably would have died because no one would have been able to get him to the help he needed fast enough. Luckily, someone was with him and got him to the hospital because they noticed that he was having chills and shaking and wasn't acting right. So just a little something to bring it home to you, to let you know my personal experience with dealing with sepsis with a family member. And I was just amazed at how fast it came on and how, despite a lot of efforts, all they were doing was kind of holding things off. They weren't really able to get things back to normal very quickly at all. Since I covered sepsis and low blood pressure in this past tip and trick of the week, I thought I would jump in and cover dopamine here as the med of the week. Dopamine is one of the drugs I mentioned as a pressor that would increase blood pressure, and we can use that in the field in many cases to try to treat things like septic shock. Dopamine is a sympathomimetic and an inotrope, and this basically means that it increases the effects of portions of the sympathetic nervous system, as well as increasing heart contractility. Dopamine is chemically related to epinephrine and norepinephrine, and it acts primarily on the alpha-1 and beta-1 receptors, increasing systemic vascular resistance, as well as exerting an inotropic or contractility effect on the heart. In addition, the actions of dopamine may also dilate renal and splenic vasculature, which will maintain blood flow to those organs. Dopamine is commonly used to treat hypotension associated with various types of shock. The onset of the medication is within 2 to 4 minutes, and its duration lasts 10 to 15 minutes. However, we're going to be hanging this as a drip most often in our ambulances, so it'll be continuously infused, and until you discontinue it for whatever reason, it will continue to be working on the body. Indications, as I said, are hypotension associated without hypovolemia, shock without hypovolemia, and low cardiac output states. Dopamine's not going to do much for you if you don't have the volume in the system to begin with. So if the person's in shock from bleeding out, fluid replacement is really going to be the best way to treat that type of shock, and not dopamine, at least not initially. Adverse reactions you're likely to see from dopamine are dysrhythmias, ventricular fibrillation or ventricular tachycardia, hypertension, increased myocardial oxygen demand, as well as nausea, vomiting, headache, and ischemia. You may also see some drug interactions with alkaline solutions like sodium bicarb or furosemide. So be prepared to start a second line and get the dopamine infused in a separate location if you've been giving these medications. Also, monoamine oxidase inhibitors and beryllium may also affect and potentiate the effects of dopamine, so increase its effects. And sympathomimetics and other things may exacerbate the dysrhythmia response. So if you've got other things in the system like epinephrine or things like that, you may be increasing the heart's response, the cardiac excitability response to this medication. Also, remember, because we're working on the sympathetic nervous system, if the patient is taking beta blockers, you may have a decreased effect of this medication. So you need to make sure you're aware of what it is your patient's taking, if at all possible. Basically, you want to infuse this medication through a large, stable vein to avoid the possibility of extravasation. You want to monitor to make sure that the site is still flowing and patent. And you want to monitor the patient for adverse reactions. You want to basically titrate the administration of dopamine so that you have a positive effect on blood pressure, but you don't want to increase it to the point that you're actually causing hypertension. So it's something to pay attention to. And that's going to be this week's Med of the Week, dopamine. And that, ladies and gentlemen, will wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show. I'm really looking forward to the brand new year and all the things that I can bring to you here on the Medicast. And together, we're going to stay better informed and provide information to each other in this forum of podcasting here at the Medicast. If you want to support the show, you can visit the website at www.medicast.com. Make sure you leave comments there on any of the postings and check back regularly. I try to put up articles throughout the week and not just the show notes, but other things that I come across that might be of interest to you. So I urge you to check back at the Medicast frequently. You can also visit the Medicast store at store.medicast.com. That's an Amazon affiliate link, so it's basically the Amazon website. But when you click and link through it on my website, a little bit of what you spend comes back and helps support the show. So if you're shopping there anyway and want to come by way of my site, I'd appreciate it. If you're buying textbooks in the coming year and the price is right for you, please shop through the Medicast. I appreciate all the help that you can send that way. As always, make sure you keep the comments and questions and information coming in via email. You can check in with me at podmedic@mac.com. And of course, tell a friend. Let everybody know what's going on in the Medicast community and urge your colleagues, your partners, your supervisors and educators to check out the show and contribute to the show so that we can get the information that they want to have out there. As always, remember, if you want an email update of when the next episode is posted, you can shoot me an email at podmedic@mac.com and put the word update in the subject line, and I will add you to my email update list. I don't spam anybody with that list. You basically get one, maybe two emails a week, if that, and really just announcing the next episode so that you know that it's available for you to download, as well as a little bit about what's in the show notes so that you know what to expect. I'll wrap up, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. This is one from a person, an artist that I've played before on the show. Caitlin Smith has some great tunes over available at the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. You can also check out her tunes over on the iTunes Store. And I have a link to the iTunes Store for her music right on the website in the show notes. So you can check out her music or any of the other music that I cover here on the show that's available in iTunes. You can click the link for the Medicast songs over at the iTunes Store. This song is called Hear Me. It's by Caitlin Smith from her album Silence. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next week, Scene Safety, BSI.